Welcome to the Femsplainers. I'm Danielle Crittenden.
And I'm Christina Hoff Summers.
We're very excited today. We have two segments, a surprise new feature in our first segment that I'm not going to tell you about yet. Well, you know, but I'm not going to tell the audience about
it. The Mansplainers.
Oh, sorry.
You cannot keep a secret.
Okay.
Spoiler alert.
Then we're going to be talking love and marriage and lots of other things with Caitlin Flanagan, who's a contributing editor to The Atlantic and author of two books, To Hell With All That, Loving and Loathing Our Inner Housewife, and another book called Girlland.
She's just an awesome babe. What can I say?
Right. And we can just sort out everything with her,
I think we'll sort it all out today.
Okay. Let's go to the spoiler alert mansplaining.
Toxic masculinity. Toxic masculinity.
Alert. Okay, so Christina and I are going to try this new segment called mansplaining.
It could go wrong.
Well, because it's mansplaining.
Yeah.
But we're here with two millennials, Nat and Joe. They're independent filmmakers. They live in Hollywood. And we wanted them to talk about the dating life for young men and, I guess, the working world for young men after Me Too.
So, they're speechless.
Well, Danielle, that was a very good explanation of mansplaining. But if I can take over. So mansplaining is when a man explains things, usually condescendingly, to a woman, and usually after she has explained something thoroughly, and he kind of speaks to her as if she's a child. So did that make sense to you?
Well, actually, I didn't explain it, so thank you for mansplaining. Well, what we hope to achieve in this mansplaining segment is men and women aren't, especially young men and women who are trying to date, aren't often really straightforward or honest with each other. So we feel this is a way for our female listeners, our fellow femsplainers, to hear the truth, or maybe what, the very honest opinions of men in various situations.
And what men really think.
Yeah. What men really think and
tell
what
us.
Men really
Absolutely,
want.
Absolutely, yeah. That's what we're here for, just to tell you how
this
we're feeling.
This is Joe.
What's going on right now? Yeah, this is Joe speaking. Yeah, you know, Nat, I don't think he can speak too much on the dating scene because he's, you know, he's been wifed up for quite a while now.
Well,
a splendid and lovely girlfriend.
I'm also really not an attractive guy. And I have a
He's adorable. He's adorable, but we'll move on.
Also very honest.
So let's start with, Nat, since you're the keenest mansplainer. And by the way, I just wanted to note that normally our listeners know we have cocktails, but for the mansplaining segments, we brought in beer.
Very kind.
Yeah.
So, Nat, you for a while worked in a Hollywood agency, and you were there when the Harvey Weinstein scandal broke.
Yeah, so I worked at a Beverly Hills agency.
Ooh.
It's a very important distinction if you're in the biz. Yeah, I worked at one of the major ones when the whole Me Too movement started, when the New Yorker and New York Times articles broke. And it was a very surreal experience because no one wanted to talk about it. It was tiptoe. If Trump or something happens in the news, everyone's talking about it. But everyone was going in, you know, painstakingly not talking about it. And I think in retrospect, a lot of people were kind of going back.
I think there were a lot of men in a lot of companies who were suddenly going through their file.
But I found when it happened, and then it kind of ran its course for a couple months. I mean, it's still going on, but it had that initial wave where just mail after mail was being taken down. There were a couple guys around the office who would, you know, go, "What, so I'm not even allowed to hug a woman anymore in the office?" Or, "I would love it if, you know, a woman commented on my body in this office." And in retrospect, those people have all now been fired. It was a big red flag because I'm a young guy, but every office experience I've ever had, I've never felt compelled to hug someone in the office. That's just unprofessional. So it was kind of weird where everyone was like, "How is it affecting, you know, the office?" And you're like, "Well, if you treat a woman coworker like a coworker, it was totally fine." And didn't make pervy comments to them, like nothing happened. But I actually found some of the worst offenders to have dodged a bullet and still work at some of these businesses because they happen to be well-liked.
So are you saying they're well-liked by the women too? So the women just didn't complain about them?
I think they're well-liked by the higher up at this particular company that happened to be almost entirely male. if you kind of were well-liked and had value, you could kind of escape it. But people like Harvey Weinstein, whose company was broke, much to do with his poor investments in hiring spies and was already unliked, then they were easy targets to take down and everyone was happy to help. So,
well, it seems to me, though, pretty basic to what you're saying, Nat. I mean, I remember this at the time, especially it was the sort of biggest offenders who were made to do the perp walks first from these offices. And you'd say, you know, you'd read about, I think it was the guy at Newsweek, where he would go up to his female reporters from behind and rub his crotch on them. And I think you don't need a corporate manual, am I right, to say this is probably not a good way to treat
anybody.
How are we supposed to pick up women at the office?
It's not a smooth move.
I don't know. It would kind of work with me.
Oh, Christine, I don't think.
Because the people doing it aren't handsome executives. Harvey Weinstein was probably one of the better looking ones. So.
You make a good point. Like, what happened? But this is what we're trying to find out. So as men, how do you navigate this? Because on the one hand, there are office flirtations. The world has to be peopled. There are women who would like to go out with an executive or find executive.
26% of people meet their spouse at work.
Right. So what do you do about
it? I read it in Vogue magazine.
You ask them out and you try not to date someone or comment on someone's body, who, especially if you're above them on the corporate ladder.
There's a power dynamic. I think it's a totally different conversation, right?
Yeah. I was at the lowest level. I was an assistant. And if I asked out, I mean, I have a girlfriend, but if I asked out another assistant, I don't think anyone would raise their eyebrows. If I was an agent who was sleeping with my assistant, I think, and then, helping her career and threatening to hurt her career, I think that's kind of a good guideline. And physically, don't treat your coworkers differently. If they're a man or a woman, don't grab them. Don't kiss them. Don't hug them. Shake hands. It's just act like a professional.
So do you think some of this behavior was just a legacy of another era? It was mostly older guys who, it was younger guys.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's definitely a cultural thing. I'm an unemployed filmmaker, so I can't step on too many toes. But some of the most awful things I heard in things that would light up a New York Times story were from someone, I think, 32, 33. Like, it's a cultural thing. It's a power thing.
Well, yeah, I mean, I also think a big aspect of that is people are drawn to work in agencies, particularly in Hollywood, because they have this idea of, it's sex all the time, it's so much fun. And I think it tends to attract the young people, especially not Nat. He's, you know, obviously not included in this example. But I think there's
Nat's looking a little bereft.
What are you going to say, Jeff?
No, I was just going to say, I think young people who tend to be a little pervy and disrespectful in the workplace go there with the idea that that's allowed, and they used to.
Really? Where did they get that idea?
Well, I can't say where they got it, but on my first day, I got lunch, and it's in Beverly Hills. You get lunch in Beverly Hills, and all the agencies kind of have their lunch time at the same time, and I was in a cafe, and I heard someone say, this was the moment I knew I wasn't going to fit in. He said to his coworker, he's like, let me give you a little advice. This business is about two things, getting paid and getting laid. And he said that, not, he wasn't joking. he said that, and it's pretty gross. And but that's the mindset that not everyone. I have some good friends over there, are good people, but
it's kind of a good philosophy of life.
Well, I was going to say, Joe's looking kind of disappointed. I wouldn't fit in with this one.
I like both of those things.
Usually has to do one to get the other, though.
The more you get paid.
All right, Joe.
Yes, yeah.
So you both went to college, and you went to a pretty...
Can we say the college so people know what we're dealing with?
We both
hated that.
Fancy.
We went to Swarthmore.
It's enchanting and beautiful, but a lot of angry women.
And you guys were in a fraternity.
Well, I just have one story that's so strange, and it's, it's a little personal, but...
Go ahead. Just amongst ourselves.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. So...
And our 7 million listeners.
I had recently gone through a breakup and was, sleeping around a bit, as people do in college. And I have this...
We wouldn't know
about
that. It's
okay, and your mother is not listening.
Yeah.
Guys, I certainly hope not. But I remember going home with this one girl who was very vocal, just an extremely liberal, anti-fraternity, just kind of masculinity in general.
Mm-hmm.
She'd written articles about this, and we sleep together, and afterwards she goes, "It's just like my friend told me, you're such a man in the bedroom," which was one of probably...
Was she complaining?
No.
That sounds like a good thing.
It felt
very weird. That sounds like a good thing.
No, that's what it sounds like.
Trying to impress everyone.
But it's a really strange thing when you think about that, though, and put that in the context where in the bedroom she's willing to say this thing. But out in the classroom and in the halls of the college, she would never even be caught dead saying something like that.
But it's interesting, right? And this is the dilemma that you guys are always walking, because if you say, oh, yes, but in the bedroom they want another thing, you would go down for that, you would lose your job, it's problematic.
Yeah.
Suspended.
It was scary just being around, because the thing that the initial wave, as I'm sure you remember, there was...
With his Me Too wave.
No, Title IX.
Yeah.
So it started really our spring of our freshman year. So that would have been the spring of 2013,
mm-hmm.
right? And there was this whole movement to get rid of the frats. And there was this moment where it was like the French Revolution, where you didn't even have to know the girl. Like, you never met her, never touched her.
But wrong place, wrong time,
because there was, and this has been covered, I think, especially by you, Christina, but there was no due process. So it was very scary.
People's lives were ruined. There were some terrible cases that came out.
I think a couple good friends of, not good, but a couple people in our fraternity, their lives were definitely ruined by it. But I think one of them sued the school successfully.
I think they both may have, because the schools have been losing. I know Swarthmore lost one, possibly two.
But does that cast a chill? Like, we and thank goodness this side of things is getting covered. But just in the day-to-day relations, I mean, asking a girl out, as you point out, you're dealing with this publicly.
Weren't you afraid of her? Or was it before the French Revolution?
No, this was after the fact. I was friendly with most people at Swarthmore. I mean, there were people that... I think what was really weird about going to school in the era we went to school in was there were these people that we were very close with for a long time, and their friend groups were destroyed, and there was never any conversation about it. There was never like, what do you think of this? It was suddenly like seeing new cliques form in a middle school, where you would walk into the dining hall and people that used to be sitting together are suddenly on completely separate sides of the entire college, just because of what they think you might think. They wouldn't even have the guts to ask you about it.
Let's take it now into the dating realm. So, do you need consent forms? Like, what is it? Now you're out.
You have to ask permission for every escalation.
Well, in my experience, it's actually been more the opposite. I think women I've gone on dates with, particularly in LA, are more like, "What's going on with you guys? Like, why won't anybody make a move?"
Really?
This is the real backlash.
Yeah, that would be.
No, but I'm serious. I mean, obviously, you know. This is just speaking from personal experience, but I've been on dates with two different women out there, and one of them was telling me a story about how she was on a date with a guy from Harvard who almost had a mental breakdown because he kept asking her, like, "Can I call you pretty? I don't know, when am I allowed to say something like this?" That also could have been just because he went to Harvard and he's a little self-analytical. But then I had another date with another girl who was had a very similar story, where she was just like, "What's going on with you guys?" Which was a really different kind of way to turn the phrase, right? Like, what's going on with men? How come
men are suddenly
so scared to ask us out, so scared to do really anything?
Don't women still sort of wait for men to make the first move?
They still expect you to pay for dinner or drinks or whatever, right?
I've noticed women being a little bit more forward in Los Angeles.
And wanting to pay their own way?
Yeah, there's a very...
You've been friend-zoned when that happens.
The problem with dating apps is much choice that you're never happy with one option. So
the Amazon of love.
Yeah, actually.
See, that's why I think it's better either to meet someone in college or to meet someone at work, because you know each other and you see each other in your milieu, and you know their background, and you know, and so if work becomes, you know, a dangerous place for dating.
Right.
Then I think we're going to have a lot of loneliness.
Well, the one thing I would say is, at least from my office experience, I think it's totally viable to still date at work. It's just, don't go up to a girl and grab her by the ass.
All right, let's do some quick mansplaining, quick takes. So what, when you go out on a date, what would you never ever say to a girl?
Are those real?
You know, you look exactly like my mother.
I think men are just, for the most part, hate playing that texting game. Like, don't read too much into our text messages, you know? Like, I've seen it on the other side. You know, I have a girlfriend. She has friends. She's like, what do you think this text means? And it's, hey, so are you free for dinner tonight? And it's, he doesn't mean anything other than, are you free from dinner tonight? Right. And if he takes a couple hours to respond to your text, there's a chance he's just not ghosting you. And maybe, his phone is off or something. Like,
or he's busy.
Or he's, watching a sports game. Like, that's 9 times out of 10.
Yeah.
But don't read so much.
If you're crazy smitten by a girl, wouldn't you leave the sports game and text back?
Well, who's playing?
Yeah. But there's also, I've noticed from my daughter watching her text, that there's also a huge pressure on you to be Oscar Wilde's, and like you have to be so witty on text too.
Yeah,
isn't there
it's a kind of high expectation
sure. of quality?
With your sophomore education, it must have made you good on Twitter.
It's bad, but what I would say is it's. Well, I just don't think anyone values in-person wit and charm as much as they used to.
Of course they do.
I don't know.
No, but you have to. The problem is you have to get to the in-person.
It's like a pre-job interview.
Right.
There. I mean, think about it. One day goes well, right? But people are so busy, right, that you're going to be seeing them in 3 days, right? And now you have this pressure to maintain a really good flirtatious conversation for 3 days.
That's
over
exhausting,
text.
Especially for men. Yeah,
just even watching Seinfeld and just like, oh, I called her and now we're going out Wednesday. And then that's the end of it.
Right.
So,
That's not the end of it.
Funny dog I saw on the park. And then she says, cute. And you have to go, oh, not as cute as you. And
I would even say,
especially when you're dating somebody new nowadays, there's a tendency to save the more serious conversations for texts, I've noticed. People will be kind of hesitant to get into a really serious, deep conversation about relationships on a third or fourth date. But then they'll text like, oh, how long were you dating that ex-girlfriend of yours or something? And you're like, well, this is definitely something
like
we should
hop out.
There's this tendency in our generation to kind of hide behind screens, hide behind parents even.
Right.
And that we really aren't full-grown adults in a lot of ways.
Yeah, maturity is taking way longer. And this is the thing my daughter will complain about, that you're just surrounded by men who don't expect to have any kind of responsibilities or seriousness or marriage until their 30s.
Yeah, that's...
Joe, do you feel any need to find a good woman, settle down? Work in plastics.
I don't know. It's weird. It's especially interesting because both my brother, sister, my parents, they've all settled down at pretty young ages. They've all got families, which is good because it takes, takes the attention off me from my parents. I don't know. I think there are still people that want to do that. But I think in the kind of more cultural developed cities, the standard is to wait until 28, 30, I'm established in my career. I mean, if I look at my friends who are married.
And then the girl has like 3 years before she can't, record. It becomes hard to get pregnant. Right. And then you can't have 5 kids.
Well, it's a real issue. I mean, countries like Japan are dealing with this right now.
Yeah, that's where we're going.
It's sad, but I don't know. I think
do you think it's possible there's going to be, not now, but 2 years from now, 3 years, once people start figuring it out, there's going to be a revolution and suddenly young people are going to rebel against all of the narratives and start marrying young and have a lot of kids.
I think you're going to start seeing people marrying younger.
Yeah. Because you know what? If you marry young, which my parents did, I had young parents.
Stricken.
And I had grandparents. I had my great grandparents. Everybody. Yeah. And you learn, learn from one another and you know old people, and now, and you have lots of cousins and relatives and aunts and uncles and all kinds. And now what's happening? It's so anemic. You have like the one child that was born when the mother was 38 and the father was 42 and very few relatives and no grandparents. And I think people are going to suddenly realize it's a benefit.
I think you're too hopeful. I really do.
Well,
I
have no data to back me up, but I just feel, I think there's more people now who come from divorced families.
Yeah, it's also depressing. These apps are deeply depressing, right?
Yeah, 100%.
They'll wear you down. I mean, I think you get worn down, you kind of see your parents' relationship or whatever, and I think you want, in an ideal world, you would see all that, and you're like, I want someone who is not just someone I found flicking through a screen. I want like a real connection that I can have someone.
Absolutely, and I think one thing I've noticed, at least among people I speak with in my friend group, they're always saying, oh, God, I got so much debt. I'm going to wait until I'm in a better position to really settle down. And I think, we talk about how much debt kids are in. I think that's a real determining factor. When I look at the people that are actually settled down and getting married at my age, which is God forbid that happens to me, but
it's not happening to you. Don't worry about that.
But no, they're people that they're in a better financial situation, and I don't think they want to rush into it. But then, at the same time, the romantic in me is like, you know, maybe this is something you should be rushing into.
I believe you should marry. I believe you should marry your high school sweetheart.
You do?
No, college.
Okay.
College. And I'm not going to mention my son, David. But
David, are you listening?
This isn't about you, David, if you're listening.
Are you listening?
No, because you're young and you're not so picky and you're, you know, and you and then you get together and then you change together. You grow up together. Yeah. I mean, it doesn't
Didn't you write about this in your book, Danielle?
Yes, I did. It was called What Our Mothers Didn't Tell Us, and that is a plug, but it was.
Is it available on Amazon?
It is. It's available on everywhere, but it was, and we, Christine and I talked about this in our first podcast, but it was about the merits of, especially if you're an ambitious person, getting married young as opposed
to... Get it over with. Get that over with. And then have your career.
It's the most important decision you will ever make.
And in college, you're already like there together, so you have a lot in common. And you found each other. You know it's not like a matchmaker. You know, but it's kind of like a matchmaker where you know each other's background and people, you have friends. So it's good.
You know what, Christina?
You did the right thing.
I think we're femsplaining to them now, and it was supposed to be about mansplaining.
Well, they need to
be. Do you want me to explain to you how, like, an engine works or something? I can't, but I can Google it and then explain it to you as if it was my own knowledge.
Well, you guys have been great mansplainers.
Nat is not available, but Joe is.
Joe is, and we will be posting his picture, and you will
and
be able to swipe right or left.
Yeah.
Because it will be on Instagram.
Any information you need about me, I can make available.
All right. Well, thank you for
joining. Forget what that feminist, even a feminist at Swarthmore said about him.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was a great ad.
So, I think we're going to be
great ad. This was all just a way to get Joe dates.
Small hand. Okay.
Okay.
All right. That's enough.
He's got big hands.
He's red.
Please join the Femsplainers.
Yes. Subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or your favorite podcast hangout.
And follow us on Instagram at the Femsplainer Podcast.
And find the Femsplainers on Facebook and Twitter at Femsplainers.
And learn all about us at Femsplainers.com. Thank you.
Be a Femsplainer. Oh, that was fun. I love Nat and Joe.
I'm a little triggered.
Well, now we can help you, Christina, because we're going to maybe the complete opposite side, right? And we're going to look at all of these issues from a more female or femsplaining perspective.
A more responsible perspective.
Yeah, a more grown-up perspective from Caitlin Flanagan. Hi, Caitlin. Welcome to the Femsplainers.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Are you ready to femsplain?
I'm very ready.
As you know, one of the policies we have here is for every guest, they have to tell us their favorite cocktail. And you actually said, and by the way, I love this, that you're a kind of scotch woman. You're not really a cocktail woman.
I'm not much of a drinking person at all. I must ashamedly confess.
Oh, that's a lot to admit to.
I do like a nice scotch with a big ice cube in it. When
what's your favorite scotch?
Jane Walker.
Yeah, have you done Jane Walker?
No, I haven't.
Oh.
I drink mostly what my husband buys, which is Lafroy.
Mm. That sounds good.
Well, if you're a real feminist, try the Jane Walker.
Which I'm not.
Which they brought out.
See, this is what I love about Caitlin is that she's unpredictable and a brilliant writer in this tradition of, let's say, Joan Didion. Who you just didn't know where she would stand. She would think her way into the topic. Anyway, that's my take on Caitlin.
Thank you.
Well, in the Uber to the studio, Christina and I were watching your appearance on Stephen Colbert when...
The first one.
Yeah, the first one, when your book, To Hell With All That, Loving and Loathing Our Inner Housewife, was on. And I don't think I've ever... This is, of course, the old Colbert Report, but I don't think I've ever seen him flustered the way you flustered, where he was just lobbing things at you about housewifery, and you were just going, yep, yep.
And you had the best comebacks.
Chicks, what's the deal?
Yeah.
What's their problem? Why do they feel like they need to be self-actualized and have some destiny over their lives, have their own income? Why can't they just be pregnant, naked, in the kitchen?
I like the pregnancy and I like the kitchen, but nudity in the kitchen are not a good mix. I'm safety first.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us about that.
People hate or love that appearance. You know, I knew that, and I really, although I've only met him the two times I've been on his show, I absolutely really like Stephen Colbert. He's just a very kind, good person.
I thought he was falling in love with you.
I don't think we went that far, but he definitely, I knew that, you know, he plays this persona, he did on that show, but I knew that his heart was much more on the side of, because he's so close to his mother, who was a very great mother and a housewife, I knew that he was more on the side of the things that the book was in favor of than he was really maybe ready to admit. And so I just pretended to be an extreme version. I decided to be sort of an extreme version of my character and agree to everything that he said.
Take me back to a golden age. Turn on the Wayback Machine.
Turn on the Wayback Machine. Well, in my house, it's the Today Machine. But for you, and perhaps for the audience, the Wayback Machine. Husband goes off to work. Wife has important, valuable work, and nobody puts her down for it. Mm-hmm. People think that it's really important to raise children. And feminists always talk about a time when motherhood is valued. Motherhood really was valued.
But give me a time period. When did this actually exist?
This is in the misty, hazy, never really happened time period that I'm trying to sell my book on, but let's just call it the 50s and 60s.
Okay.
Okay.
But you're saying misty, hazy never really happened. I've seen that black and white TV.
Yeah, I saw it too.
I saw it too,
but there's some questioning. Like, you know, did they really go to the moon, or was that just a tape? Some people feel Leave It to Beaver fictional. I don't know.
I say we should go further back.
Okay.
Let's go back to the feudal system.
Okay, good.
All right?
Yes.
All right?
Yes.
Well, not only did a wife know his place, but a vassal knew their place.
There was a very clearly defined, it was beyond a class system, really.
I mean, there was a time when if you were my wife and you weren't giving it up, I could say, she's crazy, lock her away.
If I were your wife and I wasn't giving it up, I would be crazy.
Mm-hmm.
It ended up being very fun, and some people absolutely loved it. And some people absolutely hated it. So it was probably my most notorious television appearance for that reason.
Well, you were dealing with a difficult topic, which is something that I've dealt with, and certainly Christina's dealt with, where you're coming out in that book, which was published in 2006, you're coming out and saying, it's okay to want to be at home with your kids. It's okay to have a kind of embrace of domesticity that is just, and probably still not, is fashionable to say. So what brought you to write that book? And what brought you to feel that way? I love that book, by the way. It was also incredibly funny.
Oh, thank you. Well, I grew up in a family that was very lefty, very, very left liberal family. My father always said he never wanted sons. He was really glad to have daughters. He really thought of us as smart, interesting people. He certainly thought we would have careers. But in my home, having children, raising children, that a woman would do that was incredibly respected. It was profoundly respected. And a lot of the ways that contemporary feminism gives this weird lip service to respecting it, that, oh, if we really respected motherhood, we would give people constant daycare away from, you know, there's all these things that are supposed to be done in the name of respecting motherhood. But in reality, it was seen as incredibly important work that took your whole self and took your heart and your intelligence. And both of my parents had come from very traumatically broken homes when they were small children and had had desperately unhappy childhoods, and very much thought to have a home where the children were really loved and really cared for and really seen, and that there were values certainly outside of the marketplace. My father was a college professor, and we lived sort of a middle class life until he later became a very successful novelist. But that work was not where you found yourself or where you lived your truest self, you know, no matter your gender, that your deepest sense of life and of who you were, an expression of your humanity, was at home and was with the people who loved you the most and whom you loved the most. It was almost like people would sometimes ask me, how did they teach that? You know, no one ever gave me any sort of list of values. You just absolutely felt that to be true.
As you were speaking, I was thinking, this is Christina here, I was thinking of several studies that I've seen about what women want. There's Catherine Hakim, she used to be at the London School of Economics, but she did sociological studies of the aspirations of women in Western Europe. And she found that about 20% of women wanted to be high-powered, full-time careerists. About 20% wanted to be full-time, stay-at-home moms. And then 60%, which she called adaptives, once I had children, they wanted to work part-time. So right. they would go in and out of the workplace. And then the Pew Research Center has done several studies and finds the same thing in the United States. And it occurs to me that we've got an organized women's movement that's very good at focusing on the needs and aspirations of that 20% careerists. But women that want other things, it's as if they were left behind by the Orthodox women's
movement. Right. Well, the movement, the contemporary sort of mainstream feminist movement, it gets lip service. You know, it's learned enough that it has to say, oh, this is important too, and it's all about choices, and apparently any choice a woman makes by virtue of the fact that she is a woman is a wonderful choice to be made. And they really don't want young women to grow up and think that a portion of their life will be significantly given over to the raising of small children. They really don't want young women to have that message. They really, and I can understand, they cannot achieve the things they need to achieve for them to succeed in the ways they want to succeed if intelligent women are willing to do that or are wanting to do that. They absolutely, for their movement to succeed, they need women to force their way into these C-suites of corporate America. And whether you're a man or a woman, the absolute coin of the realm into getting into those jobs is ours.
Right.
Yes, you need to go to Harvard Business School, or typically if you're going to be the CEO, not an Ivy League degree, but yes, you need a certain kind of education. Yes, you need a certain kind of experience. But the number one thing you need to get into that C-suite is a huge volume of hour after hour after hour. And it means that you have to, as a man or a woman, it's not a gendered thing. Whoever you are, you have to say, I'm never going to see my children at breakfast. I'm never going to, you know, maybe one special night a week, I'll try to see them at bedtime. I'll try to cram things in on the weekend. But certainly the idea that, you know, the things that unfold during those slow hours, you cannot have those things. And so the feminist movement to achieve the things that it needs, and maybe they're right. Maybe workplace sexual harassment that we all want ended. Maybe they're right. It won't end unless you have equal representation in those C-suite jobs. Maybe they're right. We don't know right now, but they have a need and they're so successful at it. It's breathtaking to tell young, intelligent women getting their education that what is there for you at home is less valuable, less nurturing, less good for you than what's at work. And so they don't support women staying at home at all.
Well,
at all.
Let's also talk, though, about how things have changed. And, you know, your background is a little bit like my background, which is sort of middle class, where, in fact, my mother worked, but it was a different world. You still ate dinner together and things like that. But what we've seen is the woman in the C-suite, that's still a very rarefied, like that's always going to be a smaller percentage of women. The truly ambitious woman who really wants to be that Sheryl Sandberg or whoever is really going to have to make a lot of sacrifices and personal sacrifices if she's going to want to get there. And maybe it's unfair. Maybe she's going to make different sacrifices from men. But what we've also seen vanish over this time is the decline of that just middle class ideal that a woman could just take that time away. Like most women are not in jobs that they consider the be all and end all. As you say, like, and men are too. Like, men want homes too, that the home life is what is really our life and the jobs that we do are those that support our home lives. And that's something that I think even since your book was published and our books were published has gone away. That
missing for more and more people.
It's missing for more and more people.
You know, it's almost become like an upper middle class, you know, benefit that you can have.
Right,
a marriage and a home.
No, it's like a hobby for the rich. It's like yachting or something,
you know.
Right,
and we don't, and if we only had a women's movement that, I mean, to be fair, they do attend to, you know, sort of economic issues involving women, but I think they should be attending to economic issues involving the family and how you can keep a family together. And what's happened to young men, it started in the poor young men, but now it's moved into the middle class who are just not able to earn enough to form family.
Right. Nor is there any, I mean, Caitlin, you have twin sons, which I find really interesting because, of course, your second book was called Girlland, but you were writing about
right.
teenage girls, but you have twin sons who, how old are they now?
They're 20.
So,
oh my goodness.
So you're also looking at a generation talk to us about raising sons. And what Christina says, this generation of men, there's no urgency upon them to get married or take on these kinds of responsibilities. Is that right?
Generationally, I would say that that is certainly right. And oftentimes you'll read or I'll talk to young women and they're very frustrated. Why aren't men growing up in certain ways that we want them to? Why aren't they more charming? Why aren't they asking us on certain kind of dates that we'd like to have? Why are they lapsed into this endless frat bro continuum, so many of them? Mm. And the simple truth is that women don't require, you know, that whole sequence of things, the whole idea that it was a very estimable thing to get married, and it was something that you had to grow up as a man. You had to be a presentable mate. You had to be someone that a woman would say, yes, I want to build my life with you and be the shelter for the storm, from the storm for one another.
Right. Well, it also just meant, like, I need a job, and then I can get married. And it was important to get a job.
Of course, it was important to get a job. It was important to you know, show that you were the kind of man who could raise a family. And I would say that, you know, a lot of the things young women probably do look for in a young man without realizing it were some of those old things you had to do to be, you know, worthy of raising a family, such as having a job and being together and not partying all the time. That if you don't have to do those, and then, of course, sex is what changed everything, the access to sex, became when women decided that they wanted, when so many college-educated women decided that they wanted a relationship to sex, which was much more like 70s bathhouse culture ideals of sex than like anything previously seen by women in this country, that changed everything. And, you know, my friends who are gay men who have had, you know, that were young when I was young and had, were just exploring really open gay life, you know, in the cities where I lived, that kind of sex, maybe not the actual bathhouse, it really worked for them. It really was two men together can, or, you know, a series of men can absolutely live a life where sex is separate from life and emotion and feeling and endless partners. That's, you know, that's okay and even can be good. And women just, what they're finding now is that they can't live that way and that they have emotion.
Yeah, I think it's Christina here. I think it's so interesting you say that because it occurred to me when I've been reading about these Me Too stories and, you know, dreadful behavior and terrible dates and things that go on. And I thought to myself, because it did seem like a change, because it wasn't exactly like that way back in the last millennium when I was running around. And I wondered if a lot of young men got the message that, oh, well, women just want to be treated like a guy. We're all the same. And, you know, they think it would be fine if somebody grabbed them in the ass.
I think men said, mm-hmm. Okay, let me get this straight. We no longer have to get jobs. No longer have to go through elaborate courtship. You say we can just have sex and there are no consequences because you're like me. Awesome!
Okay, let's do it.
We're on it.
Right.
They're experiments.
Right.
What? This is the greatest thing.
In the Journal of Sexual Behavior or something, there was a study of how men and women differ in their response to casual invitations for sex. And, and they showed that you take a very handsome young man and he goes and propositions a girl in his class and says, I've been watching you and you're gorgeous. Let's go and have sex. Then they reversed it and had a beautiful woman, a young woman in the class, ask the guys. 70% of the guys said, okay. And 100%
sure.
of the girls, and 25% of the guys that didn't say okay, were complimented. They thought it was, and it was the exact reverse. The women were horrified. They were insulted. And 100% said no. I asked my late husband, Fred, I said, if some beautiful woman came and said, let's go have sex, you wouldn't say yes. And he just looked and said, it's never happened. But there is a difference. And again, not to harp on you know, what young women are learning in their gender studies classes or what's just out there in the magazines, but just this idea that we're the same. And I think that that's a fallacy.
Well, I think obviously there's a continuum, you know, there's a spectrum, but I think most people probably fall in the middle of the spectrum, which means we're not very much the same at all.
Right.
And I think that one of the reasons that contemporary feminism is hollow in so many ways is that it keeps promising things to young women that, and telling them that they're going to want them and enjoy them. And as soon as women don't enjoy them and don't want them, then they promise them something else. So one of the more recent promises was, we're going to make a world where there's no slut shaming. and where you can have lots of hookups and where you don't have to have any, you know, consequence of, you know, emotional or societal for behaving that way. And what we're seeing now is that young women really hate that. And they cannot
stand Well, they don't hate it. They just won't admit it. Like
instead of saying we hate it, they're creating a world where all sorts of things that aren't remotely instances of sexual assault or sexual misconduct are now being held out as flagrant examples. And to me, that was the Aziz Ansari case where, you know, he fulfilled every single obligation of somebody in a mutually agreed upon hookup.
Right.
And then she's putting him on blast and telling everybody that he was her abuser. And so what she's really saying is, what I told him in my every bit of behavior I was up for and what I believed myself to be up for, when I really got it, it made me sad and it made me feel mistreated. And the most poignant line of the whole thing, here she is, this brave sexual explorer bringing us all to this new world of just hooking up with famous men, is that when he suggested they get put their clothes on again and she came back to the room, she said, I wished he would have stroked my hair or calmed me down. Well, that's not a hookup. Mm-hmm. You know, that's not a brave sexual explorer. That's something that someone you're in a personal relationship with of some kind. And I think women of our generation have, although we were limited in many ways, we would have made mincemeat of the Aziz Ansari situation, and we would have behaved so differently than she did that we probably would have ended up getting what she actually wanted, which was probably a second date, which him to treat her nicely and have a second date with her.
Now, one of the things I sort of find baffling about this modern sexuality is that sex is the entry level to intimacy and not the end and celebration of intimacy. Like, it's the first thing you have to get out of the way before you can actually have a relationship. But tell me, Caitlin, you have two sons who are 20. What do you tell them? Mm-hmm. What do you tell them? How are they? I assume they're going into college, or and they've got
they're
to navigate
college.
This.
Well, I mean, we raised them. I have to say that I didn't think our church was the greatest church ever in some respects, but I was just looking over. I was putting away a bunch of stuff. And I thought, you know, every single week, you know, you just look at the little things they colored in and all the things they did when they were kids. Every single week, someone was talking to him in a gentle way about how you treat other people,
right?
You know, and how you don't take things from other people and how you forgive other people and how you recognize that we're all made in the likeness and image of God. And so I think that really grounded them very much so in just how to treat anybody, a girl on a date or you know, someone that you meet who's a friend. But I do feel that, you know, feminism limited the ability of me to say things to them that would have made them even kinder and better to women in particular, because I would have always said, remember, hold a door for a girl. I would have said that before. And now I can't send them into the modern world saying, hold a door for a girl and not a guy. That would be very offensive.
Oh, my God, girls still like it. I think you would tell them not to?
I would tell them to do it.
Well,
I have to tell them too.
And one of them would really, I'm telling you right now, would have handed it right back to me, because I've got one. My boys are very different. But one of them would have said, Mom, that's sexist. He would certainly have said, Mom, that is sexist to say do this for a girl or do that.
Oh, that's such a terrible thing that he's learned. And I know there are a lot of kids that think that. But these are just gestures that men made to show a certain understanding that they are more physically powerful. And it was we evolved these manners and gestures to show
to
respect.
Those, and to tame those eruptions that we now are so upset that we've unleashed, that when men treat you brutally.
Do they think they shouldn't pay on the first date?
I certainly have trained them to pay on a first date, but I'm often one to say, you know, I think they probably left a lot of this more to their father than...
I know, but a lot of boys are confused. But I've never met a girl who doesn't resent Dutch treat.
Oh,
are you allowed to say Dutch treat?
To be fair to the boys, and I've had, if there's one question
young men ask me
all the time, is like, so why do I have to pay? And my answer is just, look, you just have to pay, okay? You just pay. Just accept that. That's a part of being a man. And they look at me bewildered, but then they do it. But it's totally, I mean, it makes no rational sense, but that's only because we're hewing to an ideological view of the sexes and not one, like, as you say, with your, you know, what do women really want? They might put forth that we want, you know, we want to be treated exactly the same. We want to have the same sex lives. We don't need the door held open for us. Thank you. And no, well, we didn't want to pay for our dinner.
Right. I don't know. I think it is a confused and confusing world that they're in. And I don't see I don't see young women being very happy currently. They're very angry about things all the time. And, you know, and they definitely, but I have to applaud them in the sense that they have gained a tremendous amount of power. And I don't think that it's necessarily being used towards things that are ultimately going to make them happy. But they've certainly, in a very shrewd way, the contemporary feminist movement, in a very shrewd way, has sized up the way that you can get power in this culture.
Yes.
And has used it and have, you know, the way that in earlier generations might have used their femininity as a means of wiling extra things out of men. They use their proud womanhood as a way of wiling extra things out of men.
Yeah, no, because and I think they've taken advantage of male gallantry. And so they,
yes, that's, you know, what I'm saying. Yeah. They have.
It is, and it is a dreadful thing that's happened. I agree.
Yeah. Will you still love me
tomorrow? Tonight with words unspoken. You said that I'm the only one.
Well, I'm going to play dumb quite genuinely right now. Because what does the modern feminist movement mean? Like, I have two daughters and a son. My son is 24. My daughter, eldest, is 26. And I have a 16-year-old in 10th grade in high school. So I'm sort of getting the gamut, the overview of young adulthood in the modern day.
Right.
And to the degree that they listen to a actual feminist movement, and the only time any of them has encountered that is really on campus. And my son kind of just blocked it out. You know, those girls who with the woke jackets who are shouting down Christina, you know, they're not doing that in the office. Like, you're not going to wear your woke jacket in on your first day of the job. I think this is more just sort of cultural detritus that is left over, that nobody, we've left this generation, and even you, Caitlin, who is like such a strong advocate for, you know, certain types of traditions and family, they still are coming out of it just super confused. And I don't know that feminism per se is to blame, because I don't even think it has a voice. I just look at a landscape of young men and women being utterly, utterly confused about how to act.
Yeah. A lot of that confusion is reinforced in the media, in the women's magazines, this idea of toxic masculinity. And there is such a thing as toxic masculinity, but it's not the average young man. The average young man evinces healthy masculinity. And there's a lot of so
well,
much.
Well, there's
goodness.
Also toxic femininity that we don't hear about.
Yeah.
And toxic femininity is getting together with your little coven and deciding to destroy some young man because the hookup didn't go well.
But that what she did to Aziz Ansari, I thought it was so humiliating to him.
So humiliated. And they've learned these code words on campus, unsafe, uncomfortable. And they hold and wave those words out the way women of an earlier age would have held out words looking for a man to rescue her from some situation she's gotten herself into.
Oh, it's the damsel in distress narrative.
It's Victoria. Very much, but it's like the empowered, angry damsel in distress.
Right.
It's like,
we've empowered. They used to just faint.
Yes, but now they're like super empowered, and they have these words that speak to the fact that they can't even be ever uncomfortable. You know what? You're supposed to be uncomfortable in college. The whole thing's supposed to be uncomfortable. You're supposed to be kind of glad at the end when it's over, like, because you're being confronted with these ideas, you know, different people, living in the dorms, the whole thing. It's not supposed to be a great fit for 4 years. Mm-hmm. But they think that because they're a woman, if they say they feel uncomfortable, that things are going to change for them. So I think it's a pretty now, but then we also have to say that the larger movement itself certainly has achieved really important things and really great things. It's just in kind of a weird end stage now where the substantive things have all been achieved. They've all been achieved. And
but here's something now, positive about, I think, about the millennials. They're problem solvers, and I think they could address this social confusion. But I'm just worried their way of addressing it is going to be, you know, to ramp up the kind of Me Too accusatory
culture. What are the new challenges? Let's like spell them out. What do you think, like, Caitlin, from the perspective of you as a mother and to these boys, what do you think is the biggest challenge facing their generation?
Well, I think that as long as you have carefully raised, nice, middle-class girls, I'll use all those coded phrases, because that's kind of the cohort that's really behaving in a different way. Mm-hmm. As long as you have them thinking they'll be happier if they have intense sexual experiences starting at an early age and experiences that are largely informed by pornography when they're still very young, and that all of that will make them happy. And if they end up not happy after those, that it's because of the patriarchy. As long as you have that, you're going to have tremendous confusion and tremendous unhappiness. And they, you know, so all of us, society, and even I, and I'm really kind of talking about this a lot and think about it a lot, the extent to we don't want to admit how much pornography has come in as a side factor. So that if just girls had come with this idea that we're going to be as sexually free as kind of the high school guy in the 50s would have been if he could have been, you know, that's the high school jock, along came completely unprompted by feminism in any way, intense online pornography. And young women, to a woman, they believe that pornography is this infinite variety of sexual tastes, and you simply go on as a savvy consumer and find your taste, and then that's the porn you watch. When in fact, to a tremendous extent, the influence is going the other way. Mm-hmm. And pornography is greatly shaping the sexual experience and desire and understanding of what's normal sexual interaction between two people who barely know each other.
You've written a lot about porn, and I think this is something we're going to be talking a lot about on our podcast.
I don't see us.
Well, not, I mean, not graphically. I mean, not like, no, what I mean is, I think this is right. I'm just speaking now as the mother of a 16-year-old. It never occurred to me that I'd have to do as I've done lately is, you know, if a boy is expecting you to do this kind of thing, you don't have to do that. Like, that's not normal. And that's not part of a loving, consensual.
My mother didn't have to tell me that. She never told me anything. But
no, but you have this.
She wouldn't have told me that.
I know. Well, we never thought we had to. And it's, I think what is strange, and I think that what the Aziz Ansari thing showed us was, like, I was just, I don't know, gobsmacked that these women are just going into these situations and they're behaving like something you would see on Pornhub. And I'm not blaming them, but it's just like, that's the expectation. You know, you walk in and that's what you're expected to do. That just struck me as insane.
But the main thing to me about that young woman is that what her, if any of us being older gals, you know, back in the day, right. You know, so if some famous guy had invited me on a date, I'm sure I would have been as excited as she was. I'm sure I would have spent the afternoon choosing the right outfit as she did. I'm sure I would have, you know, she was texting pictures to her friends. I'm sure I would have called my best friend and said, I think I'm going to wear this. I think I'm going to wear that.
Right.
And by the way, she was so excited to have a fancy date with him that he, I think, just expected she was going to come over for a hookup. But she called and said, what should I wear? What's the dress code? She'd already been running after him, and he's like, oh my God. He's like, well, I'll just wear something, you know, we'll go out to dinner. So he doesn't even really want to have dinner with her, but she would have picked up. So then if I'd gone out to dinner with him, and he'd clearly not been interested in anything I had to say, if he'd been rushing me through food, if he was, you know, grabbing the check before we'd even thought about dessert, and then trying to hustle me back to his apartment, I would have, just without even thinking about it and not trying to follow any, like, hard-to-get rules, I would have thought, well, this hasn't worked out. And I would have hailed a cab and would have said, thank you for dinner. Nice to meet you. And I would have left. And then he would have looked at those receding taillights and he would have thought, huh, she's different.
Mm-hmm.
There's all those other women. They go right back to the apartment. They have sex. I was really not listening to her that much, but she didn't want to go back with me. And at the worst case scenario, I wouldn't have dealt with him in the apartment. And, you know, I'm thinking back a long time, but probably he would have called the next day. Because men are incredibly motivated by getting things that are hard to get. They are incredibly
the old
motivated.
Chase. You they have to rewrite that book. What was it called? The Rules?
Oh, yeah. We need an rules. Update of the Rules. The Rules was like that idea. It was like, but for modern life, like one of the funniest things I found about The Rules, I remember, was like...
Tell people what The Rules...
Oh, The Rules was this... It was completely
against the times.
Oh, right. And
everybody
the feminist groups criticized it, but it was like... He's just not that into you.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, it was a kind of way to explain to modern women, no matter what you think about equality and rights and blah, 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 honestly, do not spend more than 4 minutes with him on the phone. If you're talking to him for 20 minutes on the phone, telling him about all your problems, he's not going to call again. And, you know, it's just like very basic, please try and play a little hard to get rules. And... Because we've lost all of that sense of play between men and women because we're not allowed to acknowledge that there are differences men and women.
Differences, and
courtship.
That it was fun. There was kind of these exchanges that...
Well, if you want to make it
but
more...
But I think it was larger than that because when that book came out, I thought that was kind of... I really didn't like that book because it was just sort of this commodity... It was
How to Trap a Guy.
Right, how to trap a guy, and I thought that was kind of like insulting to women too, that we would have to, what it came out of, because I'm so old, when I would have taken a cab and left Aziz Ansari at the restaurant, it would not have been out of any plan or plot or trick. It would have been that I absolutely had a sense that I was a worthy person.
Right.
And that I had something to say, and that I was used to being at dinner with people, and people being interested and wanting to hear more about what my thoughts were. And that if I had gone to dinner with some guy who wasn't interested in that, I was like, not for me.
Well, that's what I've tried to imbue my daughters with. My husband once said to me when I was in a different circumstance trying to negotiate in a job, and he said, look, people are going to treat you the way you ask to be treated. That is true between men and women, that the women, if you value your, like everything that we believe in about modern feminism, that you value yourself, you figure out who you are, these stories, it's exactly as you say, Caitlin, these women, it's like they don't value themselves. Like, you don't have, that's as I say to my younger daughter,
that's
you don't have to do
the poison of feminism right there, that it taught them that they should not value their body at all as a separate
I'm just going to object about one thing. I probably would have gone home with Aziz, and I did value myself. There has to be a place for bad girls.
Okay, but had you done that, and we don't need to visualize that too much, but had you done that...
I mean, this is my much younger self. It wouldn't happen now.
But there's the point. You wouldn't have then gone on to complain about
it. Oh, God, never.
You would have gone, whoa, we had quite the night.
Yeah, and then I would have been talking to all my girlfriends. I would have talked about it like mad to my girlfriends. And I always thought,
I think you're right. It's like when you have a bad date or you do something you're ashamed of, you're suddenly discriminated. It's a power thing, not just, whoa, I shouldn't have done that. That was bad. And not to take away from other instances where bad things happen, but these are things where you sort of enter into it by choice. You wake up, you say, oh God, why did I do that? Yeah. And then you make it into this feministic issue.
I would much rather be out with the waiter at the restaurant who really thought I was giving great conversation than with the famous comic who didn't care what I was saying.
You are responsible for your own actions. And I think what bothers us about these and these other cases is that we are taking that away from women.
That's the point.
If you're plastered and some guy takes advantage of you, that's obviously wrong. Maybe you shouldn't have got plastered. You maybe should take responsibility for your drinking, which is also a big problem on these campuses. But that being said, look, we have to take responsibility for our choices and what we do. And you can't just the next day decide it was a bad idea and then blame the man without cause.
But also, our sex lives, there's that great moment in Tootsie when Terry Garr is having that breakdown with Dustin Hoffman because she's in love with him and he's not in love with her. And she said, I've done everything I can do. I've gone to self-actualization classes. I've read the Cinderella Complex. I know I'm responsible for my own orgasm. It's like, yeah, you're responsible for your own orgasm. If you want to have a good sex life, you do not go home with a dweeby comic, you know? I live in L.A. I know a ton of comics. I know their girlfriends. They're not great lovers. That's just
right.
Not...
Don't go home with a comic. That should just be a rule anyway.
A comic on a one-night stand, you know, it's like, no, that's not, it's not going to be, they go to any comic, to any comedy show. They say it all the time. They're not the guy you want to have a one-night stand.
Right. Plus, they're going to put you in one of their bits. One of the things you write about and have talked about, which I really love, going back a little bit to your housewife, but for example, when you're on Colbert, he's challenging you about the 1950s and this idea of the housewife and Leave It to Beaver. But that's a kind of myth of the 50s too, that the 50s were also a time that were 50s and 60s, we should lump them together, that were very glamorous. People were all married, but the idea that it was this chaste, Leave It to Beaver world is a complete misrepresentation.
You described in your book the parties with cocktails and adults, and they were not child-inclusive the way everything is today. There was an adult culture, which we've lost.
Right. I mean, this is the whole that always bedeviled me, is that, you know, there were so many things that to move forward in ways that we absolutely had to, absolutely in terms of civil rights, absolutely in terms of gay rights, and absolutely in terms of women's rights, in terms of, you know, getting your own credit card, getting your own mortgage, getting, you know, your own chance at a job that was still largely protected for returning service vets through the 50s and even into the 60s that kept women out of the job market. To get all of those things that we desperately need to be the right country we need to be, we had to break down lots and lots and lots of conventions. And we had to challenge a lot of conventional thinking about things and change laws. And all of those things are really good. But there's certain aspects of social life and of family life that have just really imploded. Mm-hmm. And now, as you're saying, this most important thing for a poor family, impoverished family, is for the parents to be married and to stay together and to raise those kids, because it is just a greased slide into poverty if you're already poor and then you have children by a couple of different men. It's just, it's impossible almost.
And you know what's happened now is that you look at upper middle class kids, they do get married and have beautiful weddings and children, and they stay married. Divorce is down with the cognitive elites.
Yeah.
But as my colleague Charles Murray says, they don't preach what they practice. And there's no emphasis you won't find in journalism overall or in the media, in entertainment, about family life, about family stability, the importance of fathers. That's kind of lost in the popular
culture. Oh, completely.
And the economic base that makes it possible has crumbled. And part of it, I think, is our failure to educate boys. And I'm not talking about upper middle class boys. They get educated. But middle class and poor boys, white, black, Hispanic, it doesn't matter, educationally neglected. The girls are doing relatively better. There's been a revolution in education for Hispanic girls, African-American girls. It's astonishing. They're now about as likely to go to college as a white boy. Just the rates are amazing. But what's happened to the working class white boys and black and Hispanic? They are way behind their...
It's going to catch up with us, and some people say it already has, but that's really going to be catching up with us. And I think that part of the pernicious thing is that you have these young people in college who are very eager to tear down the establishment, as all college kids are. And then, as all the demographics are showing us, they, you know, in fact get married, and they in fact have children. They in fact have very stable, in some respects, kind of old-fashioned marriages, but they still now constitute the new class of journalists and of public policy people. And they keep those old college notions alive in their journalism, in their public policy advocacy, in their public health stuff, all of those woke ideals that they realized as soon as they got their heads above water and grew up, well, I'm not going to live that way. I'm not going to have kids by two fathers. I'm not going to be chasing child support checks. I'm not going to raise a child without a partner. They, of course, know it's not good for them. It's terrible for you. It's absolutely terrible for you. But they promote it and push it relentlessly in the mainstream press and policy institutes. And that's why, you know, pick up the New York Times and read some wonderful piece of life story piece about some enterprising woman who has put together some sort of family of people drifting out and how wonderful it is. And I guarantee you, if the writer's over 33, she's married. And she's going to have kids, because that life's not good enough for her, but it's for sure good enough for her to endlessly, endlessly promote to others so that she can seem more woke and that she can spread that poison as far as she can.
But don't you think these people now, this is a little bit about the rise of Me Too, which I know you've written a lot about as well, they kind of got it between the eyes from Donald Trump. And I sometimes, when I'm sort of upset by things that are going on, I think, you know, there are these gifts of Trump. I mean, in terms of sort of, I think he's, I mean, do you agree with me that he's kind of laid the groundwork, aside from Harvey Weinstein, for the Me Too movement, that this fact that we've gotten away from kind of the institutionalized feminism that, as you say, is through all these various organs and press and things, into this kind of people coming together and saying, this is not acceptable
enough.
You know, especially, and as you've written, and love to go into this, revisiting Bill Clinton and his scandals.
Well, that's what I always say. If you want to abuse women with impunity, all you need to do is become the president of the United States. I mean, look at Jack Kennedy.
Right.
Bill
it's just
Clinton,
a rule.
Donald Trump. It's like, that is the way to go. You know, you just simply got to become a president. I don't think there's any gifts from Donald Trump. And I think that
she doesn't mean it that way.
Well, no, in the sense that he's making us all sit up.
Ironically.
No, no. I mean it like we're all having to suddenly sit up and go, we can't just drift along here. We have to do something.
I don't think if Hillary had won, she and Harvey Weinstein were, you know, tied as thieves, and she would have gotten him out of it somehow. So, you know, I guess you're right in that sense.
Right.
We can say that the Me Too movement, which is in many ways important and in many ways in danger of bringing a lot of terrible things. But yes, I think it would never have happened if she'd been in office. So it was just two horrible, horrible, horrible people in a death match. And here we've got him.
What are the terrible things you think could happen from Me Too?
Well, I think if it stays on workplace sexual harassment and it stays really focused on that issue, I know quite a bit about the processes that it goes through in corporate America and how it's been, how it gets, tends to get missed over time and in other parts of the workplace. If we stay focused on that and say it's really time to fix this very particular thing, I could say of all the things that I say, almost everything has really been taken care of that needs to be taken care of by the feminist movement. And after that, it's all lifestyle stuff and sort of poisonous pushing of things by an extreme fringe. I would say getting this right, fixing this workplace sexual harassment is really important. And it is some undone work. Like every time they would say that motherhood is this undone work. No, women make their own choices. And as I'm always telling young women, spoiler alert, now that I'm an old woman, yeah, guess what? Every older person you talk to, and talk to older people, what was the most best part of their lives? Always tell you when their kids were little. Mm-hmm. What's the best thing you did? It was have those kids. Mm-hmm. So if you really want to live your life backward, as far as what are you going to see as the highest value of your life, mm-hmm. everyone's going to tell you, oh, it's your kids. It's not your career.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that that is undone work. And I have been very shocked by things that have come out, and particularly in the press and particularly in the media. And very glad to see these guys lose their jobs. I've looked hard to find a witch hunt, and I really haven't found a witch hunt.
I think also, and I like count myself as part of this, especially as someone who grew up in, like, literally in media my whole life, that there were a lot of us who that stuff happened. I don't mean like the gross rapey stuff. A lot of that stuff just happened, and it wasn't right. To be fair, that there was a lot of, and to be fair to the milder perpetrators, there was a kind of, this is just sort of Mad Men vibe that we grew up with. I'm not excusing it.
Yes,
and,
you are.
I remember, and this is, Caitlin, that you took Gloria Steinem to task for defending Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky. Like, that was jaw-dropping, and I remember it at the time.
I stopped being a feminist, but go on, yes.
Yeah, but we were all, I think that was also a turning point where we watched, and if not all of our audience will remember, but that was kind of the first wave. That was Andrea Dworkin. That was the era when sexual harassment on the job really came to the forefront. That was the time where if you just did a kind of Me Too look the wrong way at a woman on a job, she could sue you for harassment. And many of us were worried about, oh, it went too far. And then Bill Clinton really took it too far. And he was defended by the most important...
Wait, I don't want to defend Bill Clinton, but let's talk about the harassment. Monica Lewinsky was consensual, no?
Yeah, but she now feels she was very young and he abused his position in power. The point was...
She was 23.
Okay, the point...
Well, I would say the person who postponed the Me Too movement this long was Gloria Steinem and her ilk, and I'll tell you why. After Anita Hill, the country was ready for Me Too. And right. Feminists were really promoting an important right. idea, saying that any kind of sexual relationship between a boss and someone who worked beneath that person on the org chart was, by definition, sexual harassment.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole country was really turning around to that. And there was we didn't have the term Me Too, but women all around the country of all political stripes and all jobs were saying, yes, this has happened to us. We stand up with this new movement. And then in comes this president who's giving us, abortion. He's very on the right side of everything.
Right.
And then it turns out that he's done the very thing that after Anita Hill, the whole country was sort of galvanized around it being problematic, which is to have a sexual relationship where there's no greater job power differential possible in the United States of America than an unpaid intern and the president.
Mm-hmm.
He's done that exact thing. And no less a face and name of feminism than Gloria Steinem came forward and said, oh, come on, everybody, don't be silly. It was consensual. If anything, he just needs a little sex therapy. Everybody's got to grow up.
Okay, important question. I agree that Gloria Steinem was hypocritical. But the idea about sex between people with a power differential, can't that also be fun?
Okay, that sidebar, of course. Sidebar, it was probably too extreme, but this feminist movement screwed the pooch. Because
wait a minute, but doesn't the younger woman,
was the pooch consensual?
Have her power? I mean, if you're young and gorgeous and, sexy, which they all are, look like way to me, isn't that powerful? A form of power?
Well, that's a great point. That's a really great point, is that what I would have said to the young woman, everything is now read through power. Everything is about power differentials. The way they read everything through intersectionality has to do with power.
Right.
And I would say to a young woman, when you sleep with a man who can't even listen to you finish a story at dinner, but you go for a one-night stand, you just gave away all your power.
I have 2 points to that. First, I think if Monica Lewinsky had never come to light, everybody would have been happy.
Yep.
Like she did become a whipping girl, as it were. Like
she would have had a great story to tell.
She would have
friends.
A great story. She would have like.
I blame Ken Starr.
Okay, but I think also at root of these two stories, the pass on Trump by the right and the evangelicals, and the pass on Bill Clinton by the feminists. Really, it comes down to abortion, right? That
always
that they were for Bill Clinton, they would do anything to protect the pro-choice president.
Correct.
And now, even though they believe Trump will defend the pro-life side, so they'll now forgive him anything too. And that's, again, another podcast, but to get into how the pro-life, pro-choice movement has formed these views of modern women and feminism and politics
it's
a strange thing. But I think that's what was going on. Just as the judges are important to the right, abortion was important to the left at that time.
Right, absolutely. And it's going to cleave us apart as a country forever, I think. I don't think we'll ever get really together on this issue. And it's such an important issue. I mean, that's where I say with Gloria Steinem and Bill Clinton and that ancient history. Before that, I had thought, I love being a feminist. I'm going to make these decisions. And one of the decisions is I'm always going to believe a woman. And that's what I'm going to do. And then when that all happened, and the most important feminist in the country said, of course, don't believe this woman, that's when I realized I'm going to have to build a value system for myself that is about taking people as individuals and isn't about being in this kind of like being in a union of women and just saying, whenever a woman does something, I'll go to the mat for it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to have to look at every single case by case, and say, did this man do it? Did this man do it? I can't just stand together witlessly in a kind of a power move the way the feminists want to do. I can't do that anymore because I'll get so shocked when it turns out that we're going to turn on our own women, other women, because we want some larger goal. So that kind of radicalized me in a sense. That was when I was still in my 20s. It was a big, big moment for me when she broke ranks and said, no, we're going to choose who to believe.
Right. All right. Well, we've gone over time, but
Caitlin, thank you. Yes, please come back.
So refreshing and brilliant.
Go have a scotch.
Okay, I will.
She doesn't sound
not quite that time in California.
Okay. But thank you so much. Thank you. Okay. Keep up the great work.
Thank you.
Bye. Bye.